Blog Talk Radio.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to Blogger News on the Radio. My name is Simon Barrett, and I will be your host for the next 30 minutes. Today's program is going to be about website content and its importance in reference to getting noticed by those search engines. My guest today is Robert Hayes, the founder of DocRocket, a company that specializes in website content. Good morning, Robert, and welcome to the program.
Good morning, Simon. Thank you for having me. It's great to be here.
I think the last time Google released any data, which was a few years ago, they claim to have indexed over 8.5 billion web pages. In other words, there's an awful lot of web pages floating around on the internet, and every site owner wants to get on that coveted page one of a Google search. According to most, quote, experts, the key to getting good rankings in Google is content. Content is king, and that is your area of expertise. Tell us a little bit about DocRocket and what you actually do.
I'd be glad to, Simon. DocRocket was started around the year 2002. We are a web content provider. We also do other writing, but web content is our main focus. We have built a network of about 500 freelancers who we use to put together content projects for clients in all ranges of industry, from auto parts to healthcare to credit counseling, pretty much anything you see online, DocRocket has written that type of content. Our primary focus with our clients is helping them to build an amazing web presence for their business or their organization. And we do that by discussing with each client what their needs are, what their goal is with their website. Getting to Google number one is a big goal for a lot of people, but it's not the only goal. And then we put together content projects for them. We essentially are an outsourced writing service so that your auto parts company doesn't need to hire writers, which you know very little about. You concentrate on the auto parts, we concentrate on the writing, and everybody wins.
Right. You said you had a group of some 500 freelancers. Do they specialize in specific areas, or basically you'll take any subject and research it?
We do have people who specialize. Our approach has always been kind of a social networking approach of recruiting a large pool of writers and then matching projects to the right people. Some of our writers know certain areas of expertise to a greater extent than others. What we'll generally do if we get a project that has a specific knowledge requirement is that we will first poll our existing writer base to find who has the right knowledge and the right skills. So, for example, if you wanted to do a website about bicycles, we would look through our database and we would find every one of our writers who listed bicycling as one of their personal hobbies or something that they've written about in the past or something that they work on in the real world. If we don't find that, then we'll go and do the research and create the knowledge ourselves. So over time, we've built up a large number of topics where we have people who have expertise.
Right. So let's say I approach you and I do want to create a site about bicycles. I run a bicycle repair service, for example, and to get noticed, I know that what I need is some content. How would you approach that project? Would you kind of sit down with me and map out the general categories of articles that you wanted, types of bicycles, brands of bicycles?
The first thing we would do, Simon, is that we would find out what exactly your goal is regarding your website.
Are you still with us? Uh-oh. I think we
increase your
have...
profile on a national scale, or are you trying to build your credibility as a personal bicycle expert? Because there's a lot of different approaches that we would take depending on exactly what you wanted. A typical client is someone who is fairly bottom-line focused. They want more customers to come in to their shop. So we would look at your existing customers and what brings them to you and what kinds of things they're interested in. And then we would compare that to what's available out there on the Internet. For example, if you're a bike repair shop, you might think, well, the immediate obvious thing to do is I'm going to write articles about various bicycle repair techniques and how we apply them. And that might be a great idea. But the number one guy on Google right now might have already done that. And so if we just do the same type of project, you're not likely to get the same kind of attention that he got when he did it the first time. Because you're a wannabe. You're a, you know, you've done, it's been done before.
Right.
We would, from that point, once we knew what you wanted to do, we would build a keyword list. And that's the words on Google that you want the most attention from. I'm afraid I'm not really a bicycle expert.
Well, let's change the industry to one you're more comfortable with.
Make it laptop computers. I know a lot about laptop computers.
Okay, laptop
computers. And there are a billion laptop computer sites out there because they're high-value keywords. A good place to advertise. We might then make a list of every laptop model out there in the whole world that's currently on sale and write one article, possibly even saying something similar, for each of those laptop keywords. And we might write an article about the Lenovo LX1120 notebook. And then we might write another article for you about the Dell Mini 10 netbook. And, you know, we produce 100 of these for you. And with different keywords on each article, so that people going to Google and searching would be coming back to your site periodically. Oh, I want to learn about the Lenovo 1120. I typed it in. Ah, Simon's Computer Shop. What's this? Click. They read the article. They contact your business. You're happy.
Right. So there's obviously a great importance in these keywords.
Yes, the keywords are critical because that's what people type in. You can get over-focused on keywords. I see a lot of articles out on websites where the keywords are great, but the article itself really doesn't meet the needs of the reader. And that can be very counterproductive because you don't build credibility from that kind of an article. People who get misleading searches are generally unhappy when they reach the page, and it's not about what they wanted it to be about.
Right, and there's an awful lot of huge websites that really have worthless content.
Absolutely.
I do a lot of music reviews and interviews with musicians, and one of the things I like to do before I talk to a musician is basically Google them and see what people are saying. And I've come to recognize the sites to avoid, but you know, there are sites that have literally hundreds of thousands of pages. They'll have virtually every artist and every CD that has been released, but there's no content. Just a database-driven system that takes you to a page that says, here's his CD and here's his name.
And you see a lot of those. It's a while ago I was working on a content creation technique that we don't really use anymore. But in the course of doing that research, we realized a lot of people on the web are using what I call a poop farm approach. They have crap content, and they think, if I have enough of this crap content, it will attract flies. And I can capture those flies and sell them. You know, the flies are my meat. And you can do that. You can build a site of, you know, 17 million articles, none of which have any meaningful content whatsoever, and are simply keywords and links and things that other people have created and that you've scraped, essentially. And that does work. But at the end of the day, you're standing on top of a mountain of crap. And you're not going to attract anything more interesting than flies.
Right, but to a lot
the right approach, to extend the metaphor, you don't pile your crap in a mountain and wait for flies to come. You fertilize plants with crap. You've got to put, you know, the Google keywording is the crap. Real content articles, real audiences, real communities, real websites are your actual crops that grow. And you can fertilize them with those techniques. You can make them grow faster, make them grow better, get more people interested in what quality product you're offering online. And by product, I mean your content, not your direct business product. But
right.
You have to use it properly.
Right. I was reading an article recently by a gentleman by the name of Matt Cutts. I don't know if you're familiar with him. He's in charge of Google's web spam project, and he was saying that Google is starting to take a much more serious look at these websites with meaningless content, and basically the big stick is coming out. So, you know, with any sort of luck, I think we will see some improvement from the Google search engine, and maybe
that
won't
be great.
Right. I think that would be in everyone's best interest.
With the exception of a few people who create garbage, yes, it would be in everyone's interest. That has always been the main problem with Google and why people keep trying to compete with them. It's their competitive weakness, really, is that machine-based algorithm can be fooled, and once the black hat operators, that's what we call them, once the black hats figure out the technique or figure out a security hole in Google or figure out a way around their quality controls, you get more garbage.
Are you still with us there, Robert?
Nothing in there is going to be machine-generated. Maybe the initial cut will be machine-generated. But human input has to come in at some point, because a human being can look at two web pages and immediately say, well, this one here is junk, and this one here is great. This one's good material. But I can write a computer program to produce that first kind of article in a way that Google can't tell the difference, that Google's computer cannot look at two articles and tell which one of them is good. It can only tell which one of them has the right keyword density, which one of them has the right structure, which one of them has the correct links, the right tags, all these various technical things. But computers are just extraordinarily poor at assessing the quality of a written piece of content. And on the Internet, it's extremely hard because there's so many complexities. They could make a good stab at an automated quality system if it was just plain text, if that's all they had to deal with was text. But unfortunately, they don't. They have pictures, they have links, and you can have a site which has very little of what we would call content, but is nonetheless a very high-quality site. For example, YouTube, there's very little good written content there. You know, an automated algorithm is going to look at YouTube and say, well, this is all links and files. This is a junk site. But in fact, YouTube is a very high-value site. It's very hard for computers to do that, and that's why a lot of people think that there has to be a greater human role.
Right.
Go ahead.
You mentioned scraping of articles. I mean, it's something that bothers me greatly because so many of my articles get scraped.
Hey, feel flattered. It means that somebody thinks you're worth copying. But
yeah, right.
No. That's probably a form of flattery you could do without.
Yes, it certainly is. For listeners not familiar with the term scraping, is where an unethical website basically just copies your articles lock, stock, and barrel and republishes them. Now, from my understanding, Google does go out and penalize sites that have what they call duplicate content. Is that your understanding?
Yes, that is in fact correct. And in fact, it's a source of considerable business for us, because unfortunately Google is not always accurate in determining who is the duplicate content. So for example, you might create your magnificent laptop website with my help, and you're getting all kinds of visitors, and then 50 people copy you. Well, eventually Google can become confused, and they can decide that your site is of low value, because look at all these duplicates of your content. That's obviously problematic for you, because it means you have to go and renew your content. You have to refresh it and change it so that Google thinks, oh, this is all now new and original. That's one reason that there was an old model of content where you could build a static content site, put up 100 articles about laptops, and then stop. And it would continue to bring you traffic and visitors over time, maybe dwindling as the relevance of your material becomes older. But with copying and with all the scraping and the duplicating sites out there, that site will fairly rapidly become deprecated in the Google index, meaning that they basically penalize you and say you're not a good site anymore. So we are now advising our clients that kind of site model really doesn't work anymore. If you're going to have a huge content site, do not put 1,000 articles up on day one and then walk away. Put 3 articles up every day for a year and continue into the future so that the site is always perceived by the Google computers as being a new site, a fresh site, an original site, not a duplicate. There are some legitimate uses for scraping, by the way, but generally speaking, it is a black hat technique, and if you're scraping, there should be a good reason why, or Google will, they will find you, and they will mark you as a baddie, and you'll be out of luck.
That poses or brings up a question. I've been trying to answer this for several years now. Google doesn't punish all duplicate content sites.
No, they don't.
I'll give you a very good example. As you well know, Blogger News is part of Google News, and I believe Google News has something like 4,500 sites worldwide that, you know, that are part of it. There's hundreds, literally hundreds, of news sites that publish AP articles. You know, mm-hmm. So an AP article may well appear on, you know, several hundred sites, and clearly, they're not being punished.
Right. To tell you the truth, I don't know what mechanism Google uses to make that determination. If I did, I would be calling you from my yacht on my personal satellite phone.
Right.
Not the phone is not the personal part. The satellite would be the personal part if I had that information.
Right.
But, sorry, my other phone.
Yeah, it does surprise me, and I've yet to find anyone that can actually answer that question. Google themselves make absolutely no mention, and I have combed through the Google help site, and all to no avail.
Unfortunately, they're in a real bind, because if they publish their criteria, if they make the rules known, then the clever buggers will go out and exploit the rules and make them worthless again.
Right.
Whereas if the rules aren't known, then the black hats are somewhat hindered. You know, they're not sure what works. They have to experiment. They have to try things. They have to expose their methods. And Google has a chance to fight back. But it means that honest content providers are in a really hard position, because they don't know what to do. They don't know what the rules are. And it's another indication to me of the need for some human input into the algorithms. But it's a difficult bind for Google. You know, they're in the position of trying to enforce the rules with what really amounts to inadequate resources. Nobody has the time to monitor 8.5 billion web pages. And it's a lot more than that these days, I'm sure.
Oh, absolutely. Yes, I'm...
I'm sorry, go ahead.
That number actually came out about 3 or 4 years ago. So it's grown considerably since then.
Yeah, I'm sure it's into the tens of billions at the very least. One model that I've seen proposed that I think would work and that I find rather compelling is that Google could start to identify individual people with their permission, people who are cooperating with them, and let those people tag their pages as being owned by that individual identifiable human being. And then Google can track people rather than sites. You know, I've done a little bit of web entrepreneurship, and I've probably had a dozen websites and hundreds, if not thousands, of pages. And it's very hard for Google to keep track of all of that. But if Google knew that Robert Hayes was the creator, you know, Robert Hayes, ID number, long string of codes, was the author of all of these pages, then Google could assess my quality as a contributor to the web or as a contributor to the Internet and start judging my pages with that in mind. So, for example, Simon Barrett, noted Google spammer, black hat optimizer, and all-around bad guy, his sites quickly become recognized as, oh, this is a Simon page. I bet it's a duplicate. Even if his timestamp is earlier than the other timestamp that we're comparing to try to figure out who's the real author of the content, it's Simon versus Robert, and Robert has this great reputation with our system. I bet Simon's the scammer. Let's shut his page down.
Hmm.
Now, there would be just as many problems, but I think the problems would be smaller in their magnitude. It would be more unfair to certain marketers because once you got a bad reputation, it would be very difficult. And then you get into identity verification and a lot of other side issues. It would not be a trivial fix. It's not like saying, oh, just go do this and everything will be wonderful. No, it's just an approach that could be taken that might have more prospect of helping us get really high-quality search results on web content if we knew really who the authors were and if we knew really who the publisher was. Publisher is really probably the right word rather than author.
That's a very interesting theory, and I've got to admit, I had never heard of it before, but I think it has some real potential. So that's a great idea, Robert. You should write to Google. Dear Google.
I should. I'll send them a note, and I'm sure that they will immediately drop everything and re-architect the Internet to meet my preferences. But they've grown very fast, of course, and have made a lot of money, which mostly they deserve. But they're in a position where they're kind of in charge, not because they're actually in charge, but because they got there first. I don't know if you've ever gone to a party and someone, and there's no formal DJ, but there's a radio, and someone starts putting on music. And by the end of the party, they're essentially the unofficial DJ and party runner. They're the ones they decide which albums are going to go on. They decide what the dancing is going to be. There's no official process. No one voted for them. It's just they started doing it first. And people liked what they were doing and came along and stayed at the party. And now it's this huge, successful party. But they're still the same guy running the stereo. But as the party grows, there are more and more issues that start getting directed to, well, I think Frank's in charge. Go talk to Frank over at the stereo. And eventually Frank gets overwhelmed. And I think Google is in some danger of getting overwhelmed. There's just so many small-time and even big-time bad hats out there who want that free Google traffic. They want that free Google money. And that is, to drag this reluctantly back to Doc Rocket, that is one reason that, as you say, content is king. High-quality content will get found. Even if it doesn't make Google's number one, even if you're on page 7 of Google, if you've got a great site that really serves a need and more importantly, really builds a community, people will come back, regardless of what Google says. Google finds it for you the first time, but after that, it's in your favorites, and you go back yourself if there's something good there.
Right.
And a lot of people get so focused on Google and so focused on search engines that they forget about what are the people really doing. For example, you know, Blogger News Network has a huge audience and a great comment community, a large group of people, and probably every single person who's a regular BNN reader came to it first through Google News. Equally probably, the people who come back every day don't find us on Google News anymore. They know the site is there. It's in their favorites. It's their start page. They check it once a day. It's in their RSS feed. So once you have the eyeball, once you've gained the attention, maybe through Google, maybe through some other means, but however you've gotten it, you've got to make them want to stay. And the only way to do that is to have good content, because no one comes back for junk. No one comes back to those sites that are a list of links with, you know, where you can buy the product that you typed in. You know, no one goes back to the music sites that you mentioned with a list of every album they ever did, but with no information, just text that they've scraped from somewhere. They get the one hit. They get that one easy visit from Google, but they never get a return visitor. And return visitors are where your growth comes from. Because you can only be clever for so long. Eventually, Google will be more clever than you. There's a lot of smart people there.
Really, Google is its own worst enemy. If you look at a lot of these worthless sites, they are making money, and they're making money off Google primarily, because almost inevitably, these sites have lots of Google AdWords or AdSense.
And that actually raises a side point. I'm sorry to interrupt, but it raises a side point that a lot of these sites are tolerated by Google because Google wants them in their ad network. Google
right.
gets paid on the click. They don't care. You know, it doesn't matter to them that you clicked on it and got something you didn't want. I mean, they don't want it, a lot of that, but they don't want that to be the only thing that ever happens, because then you get sick of Google and you stop going back. They want their engine to work and to point you to quality. But when it points you to something bad and they make money, well, their incentive to fix it, they make money either way. So it kind of limits their incentive to fix it. I'm sorry for interrupting.
Oh, no, not at all. I mean, that, you've essentially gone exactly where I was headed. Google is really caught between a rock and a hard place, and you're right. They have a little incentive to fix some of these problems. I know that primarily content is your bag, but how important is website layout?
I think it varies in importance. For some things, it's absolutely critical. For other things, less so. Sites where the main purpose of the site is some kind of social interaction, and it's a community where people are talking, in that case, the functionality of the site is extremely important, but the layout can be relatively unimportant. Other things, if you're showing your graphic design studio website, it had better look good. Because if it doesn't, people are going to assume you don't know what you're doing.
Right. That's rather like sending in a resume to become a secretary and have typos in it.
Exactly. You're just shooting yourself in the foot there. I am very content-focused, so I have a certain bias towards the idea that the content is what's important. But I do think that the Internet does kind of indicate that that's true. The most profitable news-related site in the world has to be the Drudge Report, since he's got one guy. I think he has one assistant at this point. So his budget is zero, or close to zero. And he gets 1 million visitors a day on a bad day. And his layout is You know, if you turned that in your web design class at university, you would get a D, and the instructor would say, please come see me after class. I want to see your lack of motivation. But it's a perfect layout for what he's trying to do, which is just lay out, this is what I think is important today, and then here's a bunch of links to columnists that I like and news sources.
Right.
So it's very useful. Look at the – although good design doesn't have to be beautiful, some things that are beautiful can be very simple. Look at the main Google page where it's the search box. That's all that's there, and a few links. You know, most powerful page in the world.
And right, it's probably the most well-known page in the world.
Probably 2K of HTML at most. You know, there's a button, two buttons, a box, and a little bit of text. And it's brilliantly designed. It's an excellent page. I do see sites, you know, where it's all flash and animation and beautiful stuff, and my impression is that that's really just wasted effort and time.
Yes, I'm not a big fan of flash sites, and I think they're usually overdone.
The one time I think that it's really important is if you have a really aesthetic product. For example, we have a client who has a a kitchen remodeler. And kitchen remodeling is very much about beauty and aesthetics for the at the level that he's doing it. You know, it's high-end folks with marble countertops and 70,000 cubic foot refrigerators, stainless brush steel and all the rest. He does need to have a pretty site.
Right.
But in his case, equally important was the really great written content talking about his business, talking about what he does, talking about his philosophy, how he will work for you, how he'll do your kitchen. That's just as important as the pictures. But for the most part with my clients, I do tell them that the quality of the content is the most important factor. You don't want an ugly site, and you don't want a site that doesn't work. But if you can make a site that doesn't look bad and that functions well, so that, you know, when you click your buttons, you go to where you want to go and you don't get error messages and that kind of thing. If you've got that basic level of attractiveness covered, the next thing to focus on is definitely what the material is, what you're saying, what's written down.
How important is freshness? You did broach this subject earlier in our discussion. I see lots of static sites that don't change for months on end. Now, that there are some instances where that's understandable. Obviously, a static site about notebook computers isn't a good idea, right? Because the industry changes over time. But a static site about a historical event, you know, is it important to keep changing that that site, or is it fine to leave it static?
I'll give you the classic answer. It depends. You have to watch it. You have to see what's happening with the site. If people are not copying you, then it matters a lot less that your site changes. If new competitors are not entering that keyword space, if you've got a site about the Battle of Waterloo, and no one else is writing new articles about the Battle of Waterloo, again, you can get away with it. What I find the best thing to do is to have base content that doesn't change, but possibly to rearrange it once in a while, change the names of the pages once in a while, and very critically, allow comments and make sure that your frames are set up so that the comments don't appear to be a different document than the main page text.
So when Google comes a-calling, it sees fresh content.
Exactly. Oh, someone made a comment. Well, this page has been updated. Exactly. That can be a problem with a lot of the database-type sites where you're running a database in the background and, you know, you've got, and your pages look like static HTML pages to the viewer, but to Google they're a little more complicated, and sometimes it cannot understand that this page is updated because it doesn't see it as being the same page. You know, it sees each comment as being its own little micro page because that's the way the page is being delivered to the computer that's reading it on your end. Your eyeballs see it as one big block of text, but really it's not. If you've got that going on, then that technique doesn't work.
Right.
But with those It Depends in mind, yes, you need to refresh your content. It needs to change. It needs to be a dynamic. If you're wanting to look to be high on the list, if you're wanting attention, if you want Google to think your page is important, it needs to change. And one of the best changes you can have is to, of course, have other people link to it.
Yes. Now, let's talk about linking for a second. In another article I read, written by some Google guy, it said that Google uses something like 200 different factors in determining the importance of a web page. And one seemingly important factor is the number of links coming in from other sites. But
Right. It's
a double-edged sword. As I understand it, not all links are good.
That's correct. If you have... They used to be called link farms. The technique has gotten a little more sophisticated. But I'll have a page, a legitimate page, Bob's notebook page, with all my articles on it. And I notice I'm not getting enough links. People aren't really paying much attention to me. So I think, oh, here's what I'll do. I'll go start 50 blogs and 10 bogus web pages, and they'll just be garbage links to various places on my site. And that way Google will think I'm important. The Google hammer comes down, and they say, no, these sites that you are linked from are garbage sites to us. They look like crap to us. We think they're worthless. I mean, they give you a little bit of time. If you get a link from a bad site, you're doomed. Because sites take time to develop, so they don't immediately. It's not an immediate death knell. But if their algorithm is looking at your page and says, "Wow, like 37% of the links to this page are coming from these other pages that have no page rank and no one links to, and they have little content. This is spam. This is garbage," and they will ding your page. Sometimes considerably. They may even decide that your page itself is garbage and move it to what they call the sandbox, and from then on you can just forget about it.
Right.
People can get to you on the internet, but Google's not interested, and nothing you do there is going to change it.
Right. I also have read a couple of articles that claim relevancy is important. If I have my bicycle site and other bicycle sites link, then that's very good. But if I'm being linked to by sites that have no relevancy, like a laptop computer site, they go, well, why would a laptop computer site be linking to a bicycle site?
Right, they think you must be junk, must be spam. Hit them hard. I really don't know how they do that, to tell you the truth. Because I am pretty sure that they don't want to penalize just honest social connection. You know, if my computer blog, I see your bicycle site and go, oh, hey, you know, I like bikes too, I'm going to link to you. They don't want to punish you for that. I think that I don't know 100% that this is the case, but if they're not crazy, then what they do is, more relevance gets you more weight, but bad relevance doesn't hurt you. It just doesn't help you very much.
Right. That's
really the only way to do it, to keep it non-punitive to people. You know, you don't ever want people to say, please don't link me from your other legitimate site, because I don't want Google to get confused. And I think Google feels the same way. They don't want that to happen. They want that marginally relevant site to go ahead and link you, especially if there's a real connection. They just don't want to give you as much credit as they possibly would if, you know, bikeworld.com makes the link.
Right. One of the items that's a hot topic and has been for a year or so is the importance and lure of the social networking sites, Twitters and MySpaces and Facebooks of the world, how important do you see those for a website? You know, is it important, you know, for your laptop company to be involved with Twitter and MySpace?
It can be. You don't have to do it. People will tell you, oh, you've got to be on the social networking, you're doomed, and that's not true. You know, people are still going to come to you from the Yellow Pages. People who know you are still going to make referrals. People are still going to see your ads in the paper, whatever you're doing, whatever other promotional things you're doing. But if you have a personal element to your business, if it's a business where people will benefit from connecting to you or will feel a benefit from feeling connected to you, then it can be extremely powerful. Particularly if it's particularly where there's an ability to feel like you're really tightly bound to the person who's doing your work. You know, and for some things you don't care. If you're going to buy a laptop, you really don't care about the person who runs the laptop store.
Right.
Other than as a human being, you would care. But you know, the fact that he went to Vegas last weekend and had a great time, or that he's going to go skiing, or a cute picture of his kid, you could give a rip. I don't want to know. I want to know what the laptop's quality rating is and whether I'm going to get a good deal. That's what I care about. Other kinds of businesses are different. If you're what's a good example?
Well, actually, I have an excellent example for you. I work with a lot of authors. And
if an author is not on Facebook, he's an idiot.
Right. And in fact, what has become the absolute norm, and in fact, when an author isn't doing this, I'll often point it out to them, is that they will have a static page for their book. You know, which will have reviews and you know, author's biography, etc. And almost 100% of the time, they will also have a blog, and that sells more books than anything else. Because, you know, how do you appeal to a would-be reader? You've got to sell not just your book; you've got to sell yourself.
Absolutely.
And a blog's a wonderful way of doing that.
Mm-hmm. And writing is a great, any artistic production, but writing especially, is a great example of once you like the source, you'll go back for other things. You know, if you read a Paul Anderson science fiction novel and love it, you're very likely to say, what else has this guy done? And when you've got a blog experience, you know, to keep people in mind of, you know, that you're still a person, you exist, and you're doing all this other work too, you can get a huge amount of interest. And for authors especially, there's definitely that feeling of personal connection between you and the person providing you this product, this book, or music is pretty much the same, I think.
Right.
In terms of that
yeah.
emotional connection. Oh, I love this band, and I'm going to go to their Facebook page, and I'm going to download their cute pictures of their kids. I care about it. You know, I'm connected to them. And especially for writers, I remember in the pre-internet days that it was always a very rare and special thing when you'd get to hear more about a writer and their life. You know, writers would put bio notes at the end of their books, and people loved them because you didn't get to see that. And you wanted it. You wanted to know. You wanted, this person wrote this brilliant thing that I think is fantastic that became a huge part of my life. I want more connection with them. I want to know more. So for any kind of business or service or product, anything you're doing really, I would say look at whether your customers want that personal relationship. A lot of the times they will, sometimes they won't. If they do want it, then you've got to be in social networking. You've got to
right.
be in social networking.
We're rapidly running out of time here, but where can people get in touch with you if they need some website content?
Anyone who's interested in website content can visit us at www.docrocket.net, D-O-C-R-O-C-K-T. You can see our samples. You can see sites we've done. You can see our rates. You can see bios of our writers. And you can see all the great things that we can do for businesses who need writing done.
Well, I'm sure I speak for everyone here at Blogger News in hoping you a very, very successful 2010. And
thank you very much.
Yeah, and I'm looking forward to visiting you on the yacht.
I will make sure that your cabin is well equipped with all the music that you like, fine beers, and a comfortable chair for when you sit on the deck and look at the satellite launch.
That sounds great. Robert, it's always a pleasure to talk to you, and I do hope we can talk again soon.
I hope so, too. Thank you for having me, Simon, and good luck with everything you're doing this year.
Thank you. This is Simon Barrett for Blogger News Network, wishing everyone a wonderful day, and I'm sure we will be back again soon on Blog Talk Radio. Goodbye.